Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to the wonderful Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. This week, we are rerunning the opera series with Desiree Mays that aired here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe in the spring. The opera about which we are speaking this morning corresponds to the one being performed tonight at the Santa Fe Opera, which is on the web at santafeopera.org. They can also be reached by phone at 505-986-5900. Desiree Mays is here to join us. She's an international lecturer. She's the author of Opera Unveiled, now in its 13th year. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. We're going to have fun today.
We are indeed. We are talking about the opera The Last Savage, and every year there's a more contemporary opera, usually 20th century opera, and that's The Last Savage by Giancarlo Menotti. That's my Italian accent for
Very
what
good.
It's worth.
He was an American-Italian, that's fine.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he actually went to the Curtis School of Music in New York, born in Italy. And his music is Italian opera, but it's seen through the prism of an American style. So Menotti is very light. This opera is a comedy. It's funny. There's no tragic death at the end. It's very accessible. It's actually a bit of a parody. When Menotti composed this piece in the 1960s, he was having a little dig at our American way of life here. And it's fun. It's interesting that now we're looking back. In 1960 is 50 years ago. That's a long time. But many of us lived through it. So you can look back. And you can see the parody. It makes much more sense now as you see it in retrospect, and it's fun. So it's a great piece. Can we get into some of the music, Mary Charlotte?
Yeah, let's get in. Let's talk about let's set up the plot of the piece a little bit. I haven't obviously seen it because it's a new opera, and it's not. There's not a recording that is available to the public yet.
No. This was first presented in the States in 1963 at the Met, and the Met really believed in it. They pulled out all the stops and gave it an extraordinarily wonderful cast with Roberta Peters, Teresa Stratus, George London. I mean, a great cast, and it did well. But as time went on through the 60s, through the end of the century, it was Menotti's other operas that got bigger play for whatever reason. And now this is coming back, and maybe in part because it is this wonderful look back, so slightly tongue-in-cheek, with a great sense of humor about what goes on in this country. But the story is, believe it or not, about the abominable snowman. I mean, that's so crazy. When I heard that, I thought, this is ridiculous. Opera has its ridiculous moments. But it also, for me, is very enriching because I have to study all sorts of things when I present an opera.
Well, some of those Baroque operas have frog people in them.
Exactly,
like that.
Exactly. So here I am studying frogs and abominable snowmen. So it turns out that in the 1920s, this is where people would see yetis and abominable snowmen up in the Himalayas. And this is the kickoff idea for this opera. When the opera was written, you know, the existence of a mythic super beast in the Himalayas was still an intriguing possibility. And to this day, you can find articles on Google that says, yes, he's out there. No one has ever seen him. So anyway, this is the idea. And the opera opens in the home of a Maharaja, Rajaputana, near the Himalayas. And he is meeting with an American business tycoon, Mr. Scattergood. And the two of them are comparing notes. They're super wealthy, but they're a bit concerned that their wealth may not grow. So they decide that they will have their children marry Kitty, Scattergood's daughter, and Kodanda, who is the son of the Maharaja. Well, this idea sounds good until the two kids are involved, and they said, no way. You know, the Kodanda says, I don't want to marry this American girl. Why should I? I'm not going to do as I'm told.
So much for the arranged marriage.
Much for the arranged marriage. And then she arrives and she says, no way either. So I've come to the Himalayas to find the last savage. I'm working on my degree in anthropology, and I am going to find the last savage and bring him back to America and show him off. So this is the sort of the thesis for the plot. And then when the kids leave the scene, the Maharaja Maharaja and his wife and Scattergood get together and think, what are we going to do? And the Maharani says, you know, there is no last savage, but we'll invent one. We'll string her along here. So they enlist one of the servants in the palace, Abdul, who is this gorgeous hunk, this sort of Tarzan type. And he says, I can't do this. I'm a stable boy. I don't know how to act, implying I don't know how to sing, which is sort of nice little irony in this opera. Anyway, he's told that he has to go off into the jungle and pretend to be a native, and she will find him and all will be well. So I thought as a first piece, we might hear a little bit of that, where Abdul is being interviewed by the Maharaja. Would you like to make some money in a hurry? Yes, says Abdul. And he is told, all right, then, all you have to do is play the part of a wild man in the jungle. A wild man, he says. And everyone, his girlfriend, who realizes there might be money attached to this deal, says, of course he could do it. He's going to do it. So you'll hear. It's a wonderful piece of dialogue. It's all in English. So let's open with that first interview of the Maharaja with Abdul, the servant who is going to become this last savage, and Saudula, his girlfriend, who's pushing the deal forward.
Your name, Abdul. Abdul, would you like to make some money in a hurry?
Oh, yes.
All right, then. All you have to do is to play the part of a wild man in the jungle.
Of a wild man?
Me, sir.
Don't say no.
As a matter of fact, sir, I do not know how to act.
Now, darling, don't you fear it. I will show you what to do.
I did not know that there could be a fellow so naive as he.
You see, you just rely on me.
You see, it is easy as can be.
I really am not feeble. I was brought up in a stable.
You are perfect. You are perfect.
You can do it. You can do it.
You're exactly so careful. You can look in the direction. You can do it to perfection.
I would look like a fool. I have never been to school.
Now, darling, don't you worry. I will show you what to do.
He's just a simple country lick. He's just the man to do the trick.
You see, you just rely on me.
You'll see, it's easy as can be.
As a prehistoric caveman, you don't need an education. With a little preparation, you'll understand the situation. Do not cut your hair or whiskers. You're a creature of the jungle. You have never learned to speak. Your intelligence is fleeting. At first you are ferocious, then be timid and surprised. If you have to go someplace, you make your signal sound. As they do in Hollywood. Bravo. What could be simpler? As they do in Hollywood. At first you live in the jungle, then we let yourself be captured by a lady from Chicago. Then we come and take your picture, then we show you to the public. In a week or two, maybe three, we will set you free with a large compensation. This American over here will gladly pay your fee.
And we're listening to music from The Last Savage, which is an opera by Giancarlo Menotti. Now, Desiree, it sounds almost like a musical, really, compared to
it does,
an
yes.
opera.
It's a fine line, you know, what is a musical and what is operetta or light opera? Opera comique, sort of the technical terms. The technical definition is that if a work is sung from beginning to end, it's an opera. If there's any dialogue in it, it's a musical.
If they speak at all, it's a musical.
If they're speaking, right.
There have been some exceptions to that on the stage of the Santa Fe Opera, which we've witnessed.
Absolutely. Like Les Miserables, there's a lot of dialogue, but that's now being treated as an opera. opera, as is Porgy and Bess. So these are what we call crossover pieces, if you like, that appear both on the Broadway musical stage as well as in the opera house.
I think one definition could be, if you can understand what they're saying, it's a musical.
Well, that's true, too. Though that language thing is very difficult. You know, I believe firmly that if it's an Italian opera, it should be sung in Italian.
Listen, there's English operas. When we've had several of them on the stage at the Santa Fe Opera, I couldn't understand a word of the English.
You still need the titles.
And this one you can.
This one, well, yes. I mean, we'll see in the house if you can. It's a real test because for the singers, the sound of those words may not be exactly how they can enunciate them when they're singing a high C.
Right.
You know, this is part of the problem. So you still need to know the story and use those titles. It really helps. And I think if you're struggling to understand the words word for word, you're doing sort of an intellectual exercise. You're missing the magic of the music. So if you know the story, you'll get it. You don't have to follow all of the words. So.
And if you know the story, that means perhaps you've read Desiree's book,
yeah,
Opera Unveiled.
Absolutely.
And it's great fun. There was a quotation in the book from Menotti about the arts, which I was hoping you could read.
Yeah, Menotti was criticized somewhat in the years that he was composing that he did not compose in the avant-garde style of Schoenberg and 12-tone music. He doesn't. He believes in melody. He's a true Italian. But he was a little bit concerned about the state of opera in this country, in the States, and he said, "The artist in general has always been on the margin of society. We are supposed to entertain people rather than be part of their daily life." Now, this is not true in Italy. In Italy, it's really part of their life. He says that here in the States, we are the after-dinner mint rather than being the bread of society. I feel the serious artist has to find a more creative place in modern society. And that's actually why he founded the Spoleto Festival, first in Italy and then in Charleston in this country. But I think that's a wonderful quote. You know, the opera may be seen as being on the fringes of the visual arts rather than being the bread. But I promise you, when you go to an opera and it really touches you, means something to you, it becomes the bread. It's a magical transition. But it is a perception that many people have.
Now, let's go back to The Last Savage. You've got, what's the next piece
what
that
happens
we're
next? Yeah, this is a lovely aria by Kitty. Kitty, who is this young, eager, very American girl who sort of mazes everybody in India.
Sort of semi-anthropologist?
Sort of, yes, she is. She's a student. She's working on her PhD. So she takes a team of Indians out into the jungle, and they capture this Last Savage, and she brings him back. And
she's really the stable boy.
Who's really the stable boy, but he's sort of a Tarzan type. He's quite wonderful. And she's thrilled to bits. And she decides that she's not going to. The deal was that Kitty and Conanda agreed they would get married when she found her Last Savage. But she's changing the rules now. She says, "I have to take him back to Vassar. I'm going to present him to society."
She goes to Vassar,
right? And Daddy owns a penthouse in Chicago. It's all Art Deco and 1960s style. It's fabulous.
The sets are beautiful, yes.
The sets are really exciting. So here she sings. She's brought him back and she says, "Just look at him. Just look at him. I've proved his existence. You must admit that finding him took courage and persistence. But don't come too near. Right now I would advise you all to approach him with fear. At first I went unheeded, but at last I succeeded. I have brought him back alive. See that handsome body, those muscles, that torso as strong as a lion. The nails on his fingers could tear you asunder. His voice is like thunder." So all these funny rhyming couplets. Again, a bit of a parody of the earlier style of opera where this happened. And then finally she ends up saying, "See how soft his eyes are, how sweet and confiding, that look so unfeeling. Who knows what it's hiding?" So she carries on like this and gets into a wonderful cadenza where she takes off in a coloratura style, sings all those wonderful scales and embellishments. So I thought we could hear a little bit of Kitty's aria. By the way, Marichard, I should mention, this is very special, that normally you cannot play excerpts from an opera that's not out on CD and readily available. So I contacted the music publisher, Schott Music Company, who are bringing this in and who have the music and from whom I got a very special copy. And they gave me permission just for this show to be able to play some of this music. So I'm thrilled about that and you can hear it.
And so we're going to hear Kitty's aria, "Just Look at Him."
Just look at him, just look at him. I proved his existence. You must admit that finding him took courage and persistence. Oh, look at him, just. riches his beard may be hiding. Oh, say how soft his eyes are, how sweet and confiding. That look so unfeeling, that look so unfeeling.
So that's Kitty. Kitty's aria from The Last Savage by Giancarlo Monotti, and on this recording sung by Ilse Holweg, but that recording is not yet available, I'm afraid. And Anna Christie will sing the role here. This is a young singer who'd be perfect in this role. She's got this lovely light coloratura voice, and Daniel Okuluc. It'll be a young cast, which I think will work well with some tried and tested wonderful older singers in the parts of the fathers.
Well, is the stable boy going to be appropriately Tarzanish?
I would hope so. I imagine all of these gorgeous hunks in opera now seem to appear at some point sort of undressed to the waist. It's become a new thing. I mean, it's really amazing.
It makes it just that much more fun.
Absolutely. So the first act ends where she's going to take her savage back to America. Now, this was not part of the deal for Abdul, who has been offered a lot of money to do this, but he thought it would all be over once he was discovered.
So she finds this phony savage. Mm-hmm. What does she teach him English?
Oh, she teaches him everything. She teaches him how to eat with a knife and fork. She teaches him how to behave. And then she decides that she wants to go take it a step further, and she's going to give him a lesson in love. Now, he's not happy about this, but she takes him by the hand and she sits him down. In one scene, she teaches him how to kiss as the lights gently fade to black on the stage. So she's getting emotionally involved. But we've jumped ahead a little. What happened at the end of the first act? This is a two-act opera. She's made her stand. She's going to take him back to the States. The second act then is set in her father's gorgeous penthouse apartment in Chicago.
And so he's a Himalayan stable boy with a girlfriend, right, suddenly in an Art Deco Chicago
transported
penthouse.
Yes. It's that wonderful Crocodile Dundee sort of story. And he arrives in Chicago, and he's a little confused. And the opening scene is wonderful. I'm going to play a little of that. Kitty has decided she's going to throw a major party for the cognoscenti and the fashionable people of Chicago to show him off. And at this point, the section I'm going to play is where the tailors are fitting him. How do you dress a savage for a cocktail party in Chicago? So they have this wonderful debate. And as this is going on, Kitty is on the phone to all of her society friends, telling them they have to come and see her big find. So the tailors are discussing in this section how they're going to dress him. Abdul is standing still for the time being and says, "Stand still for a moment, 50 inches round his chest." They're very impressed. And Kitty's on the phone saying, "Now that he's becoming civilized, he's really a rather charming savage. No, he doesn't smell like one. He's innocent and childlike. Certain things he does not know." And then the tailors, "For a savage when he's dressed, sports attire would be the best. For a savage such as he, who is passing through Chicago, traveling clothes would be the best." So they go through this nonsense of how they're going to dress him, and she's on the phone to her friends, until finally Abdul has had enough. And he says, "This is ridiculous. I'm out of here." And the tailors are terrified at the savage, and they all run off, which is when Kitty takes him by the hand for the lesson in love. So maybe we can hear a little of this ridiculous, funny scene from the beginning of the second act of The Last Savage.
Please stand still for just a minute. minute. 50 inches!
Holy Mother, what a torso!
Now that he's becoming civilized, he is really a charming savage. No, 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 he doesn't smell like one. He is innocent and childlike. Certain things he does not know.
Or a savage when he's dressed. Sports attire would be the best.
For a savage such as he, who is passing through Chicago, traveling clothes would be the best, it seems to me. I'll introduce him to society and cocktails. Monday next, I'm inviting all Chicago. Artists, scientists, and clergy, everybody will be here.
I can see the problem clearly, though this fellow is abnormal. We should dress him quite severely. Cocktails, something dark and rather formal.
Yes, my darling, try to arrive. Monday next at 5:30.
What kind of cloth? The finest in the world. The British.
Hello, not bad, and how are you? I'll expect you Monday next. I will show you something new.
Muscles like iron and teeth like a lion.
No one has ever seen him.
Better be careful, we must not upset him.
No one else has been his teacher.
Shall we give him?
Buttons on his jacket.
Happy bolting. Something new. He's always welcome. Not in England.
He's a perfect demonstration of power and education.
He is looking rather queer.
Let's get out of here.
Oh, God,
I'm afraid he doesn't like us. I would never use a zipper.
What's the matter with the zipper?
Only
buttons, the tailors of England can never be wrong.
Oh, goodbye, dear. See you soon. Yes, on Monday afternoon.
I've had enough. Oh, this is torture. You are crazy, stupid clowns. All this fuss about my costume.
That's a very human moment. I think we've all had that, where men especially hate to be dressed for parties. You know, they have this very low tolerance, and eventually they say, out, 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 leave it alone, I'll go in my jeans, or whatever it is.
And the part that we didn't hear was the lesson in love, but people can kind of imagine that.
What goes on. Right.
The Last Savage, the opera by Giancarlo Menotti. Gosh, we're not going to really have enough time to play all the musical selections that we had prepared. Mm-hmm. But just give us a rundown of the rest of the story. Because, of course, now we really want to know what happens.
Yes, exactly. What happens?
phony savage.
And the cocktail party. And everybody comes. The religious people tell him what religion he should belong to. The philosophers, the teachers, the society ladies all invite him to parties. And, again, it's another crazy scene of cacophony. But it's a send-up of a cocktail party. It really is. And finally,
parties are send-ups of cocktail parties.
Yes, exactly. And finally, Abdul, who's the noble savage, sees through it all, and he roars. He says, enough. And he looks at Kitty. He and Kitty have been pretty close by this point, clearly. And he looks at her and he says, if this is your idea of civilization, then I'm headed back to the jungle. And he takes off and goes back to India. So the final scene then is set in India, where everybody returns. Abdul has vanished. He's gone into the jungle. The two fathers are really upset, the Maharaja and Scattergood, because their wedding plans are not working out. And Kitty is frantic because Kitty has fallen in love with her last savage. And she's told the truth. She's told that the whole thing was a setup. He's not a true savage, that this was the stable boy. And she says, it doesn't matter. I love him. And I'm going to stay and marry Abdul, which sort of appalls everybody else. But that's the plan. And Abdul is captured again. He's brought back. He doesn't want the money. He's a noble man. He says, no, I don't want to take any money for this. And Kitty says, just look at him. He's wonderful. And I'm going off to the jungle with him. And the last scene is quite wonderful. The two of them are in his jungle cave, sinking onto a mossy bank, when she looks over his shoulder and she's made a prearrangement with her dad, and there's people there, and she beckons to the people in the jungle, and they come on stage bringing a television set, a bathtub, toasters, all the symbols of Western civilization.
Which they're then, what, plugging into the tree? Well,
exactly, you know, the irony of that. And then in our production, there's even another further funny scene at the end, which we are not going to reveal. Everybody has to go and see this.
All right, then.
And the last piece of music then we should play from this is a lovely straight piece of music. It's a septet. Six people sing. Abdul is singing about how he actually loves, he's come to love Kitty. Kodanda is happy that he is not having to marry Kitty. Sardula is the servant girl who gets together with him in the end.
She's the ex-girlfriend
of Abdul, as long as he was in the money, but now there's no money involved. She's going to marry the Maharaja's son. So she's, you know, she's like, on the make.
It's like Shakespeare. Everybody marries the right person at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Or like some Shakespeare.
Yeah, and then the whole thing comes. It's a very Mozartian ending. Mozart's operas always end with a little moral. So at the end of this, they all of them sing, now at last we've found a moral, one which no one can deny. Wiser men, from king to peasant, only gamble on the present. What may happen by and by, only fools will prophesy.
How fortune waits in a hiding to surprise us. See this lovely, lovely creature, once my terrifying teacher, so superior, so above me, who'd predict that she would love me? See this lovely creature, see this lovely, lovely creature,
my adorable
my terrifying teacher, so superior, so above me,
and begin to
predict that she would love me. So superior, so above me, that she would love.
Oh, how fortune waits in
high
exercises.
And I am not so well respected.
Tell
why there's a
sign.
Yet in India I
have
such a mess of
we had to cut that. We missed the moral.
We're almost out of time. So this was The Last Savage by Giancarlo Menotti. Desiree, it's wonderful to have you here on the air.
Yeah, it's been great fun.
Desiree Mays is an international lecturer on opera. She's the author of Opera Unveiled. Desiree, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Ned Campy. He is General Director of Opera Memphis, and he is Director of The Last Savage at the Santa Fe Opera. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's talk about this opera. Give us just a quick plot synopsis of what this opera is about.
Sure. The story is basically about Kitty Scattergood, who is the daughter of the renowned Chicago millionaire Aloysius Scattergood. She is completing her PhD in anthropology at Vassar, and her father desperately wants her to get married to the son of the Maharaja of Rajputana. The story takes place in the 60s, and Scattergood is very worried that, he wants to make sure that his daughter is taken care of, so he's trying to get her into this arranged marriage with this very rich prince of Rajputana. But she refuses to get married until she completes her PhD in anthropology, and to do that, she needs a thesis, and her thesis is to find the last savage man in India. She believes there's a race of prehistoric cavemen still alive. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that there is no such thing as a race of prehistoric cavemen, and the Maharani of Rajputana realizes that if they ever want their kids to get married, they're going to have to invent a savage. So they get the boyfriend of one of the palace servants to dress up and pretend to be sort of a wild man, and they allow her to capture him, and she brings him back to Chicago to tame him and civilize him. And at the end of Act Two, there's this big party where he's presented to society, and he meets all the representatives of art and culture and politics of civilization, and he realized if this is what civilization is like, I'd much rather be a savage. And so Act Three is him going back to the jungle to become a savage and everyone else looking for him, because by this point, of course, Kitty has fallen deeply in love with him. And that is essentially the story.
And it is very funny, and this is a work from the early 1960s. It reminds me kind of that mid to late 60s political and social satire that you see a lot in films. It's a little earlier than that, and it really makes fun of society and colonialism in a big way.
Absolutely. One of the big inspirations for the piece, or I guess touchstones for me, was the Doris Day Rock Hudson movie Lover Come Back. That is a movie that from basically the same period that deals with a lot of the same themes about the role of marriage, the role of women, the role of men. What does love mean? Are love and marriage the same thing? And it was written at a time when all of these things were changing, and the idea of a woman having a job and a career outside of the family, or does she have to give that up? Can she keep that? All of these things were being dealt with in comedy in a much more blunt way, in a much more interesting way than they were being dealt with in drama. If you're laughing at something, you can actually present ideas that are much more radical and much more interesting than you can in a drama where people take it very seriously.
It's not your typical opera in the sense, there are comic operas, but it's pretty over the top in a lot of ways. Nobody dies of consumption. It's completely unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, here you are as the director. You've been thinking about this for several years because you've known you're going to do it for several years. How do you start conceiving of a production like this? I mean, there's a lot of other people involved in the production, but how do you start thinking about the tone that you want to set for something which is just so, I think, satirical, unrealistic, funny, and goofy, and kind of a period piece?
Sure. I like all of those descriptive words. We actually looked at, talking about Lover Come Back, there was a movie a few years ago called Down with Love that was a sort of a modern-day gloss on those Doris Day Rock Hudson comedies. And it basically took the essential beats and look and feel of those movies and heightened it and looked at it a little bit with a wink and a nod. The same way that when we watch a show like Mad Men today, while that's a drama, not a comedy, we look at pregnant women smoking and drinking martinis, and we're able to, we can laugh at that or be horrified by that as we desire. But so you look at a movie like that sort of looks back at the period, heightens it a little bit, just makes it a little brighter, a little more pastel colored than maybe it actually was at the time. And we tried to do the same thing. You want to look back at the period, you want to present it in some ways as it was, and actually a lot of the costumes that we have in the party scene in the 60s are actual period costumes. This was actually how people dressed. And we just, as they say, we turn it up to 11. You just make it a little more absurd, a little goofier. And with the scenes that are set in India, now that is in a mythical, what we've called Hollywood India. It wasn't supposed to take place in a kind of realistic India. It was a fantasy of what India would be, a fantasy of wealth and elephants and, rajas and that sort of thing. So we tried to be very honest with that and present a kind of fairy tale India for the beginning. And you just start looking at things, looking at research, and you just dial it up a little bit so that it stands out and it pops.
It is very funny, the party scene to which you were referring. I went to the dress rehearsal, and it was also youth night the other night, which was great fun. But you see the characters of kind of beatniks and mm-hmm. poets and musicians doing weird, over-serious German poetry and music and things like that. And it is hilarious. And I was sort of thinking, it's as funny now as it must have been in 1963, but almost in a different way.
Mm-hmm. I actually think it might be funnier. You know, it's very hard to satirize your own time. It's a little too close. And I think we're able to look back at 50 years later at the themes or the threads of music or, you know, what poetry was like. We're able to laugh at it in a very different way, you're right. But I think in a freer way, it's not quite as pungent as it might have been when it was initially written. And, you know, Menotti, he had a bone to pick with, especially with the musical establishment at the time, because he had the audacity to write music that was beautiful, that people enjoyed. Instead of writing things that were thorny and difficult and academic, he wrote music that was actually fun to listen to, that moved people. And because of that, he was critically reviled for a long period of time. And it's only now, you know, right around the time of his 100th birthday, that people are looking back at some pieces like this and saying, this is beautiful music. This is funny. This is, you know, the equal of any Donizetti opera. Why aren't we doing this anymore? So when he was satirizing, especially the musical establishment, it was very, very pointed. And I think at the time, maybe it raised some hackles that it no longer raises today. So we're able to be very free with it.
Now, I take it this is not a very often performed opera.
That is correct.
Why is that?
You know, in part just because of the scale of it. There are 18 principal roles. There are 18 people who have individual lines. And part of it is just today to hire that number of singers would be very prohibitive cost-wise. The beauty of doing it here at Santa Fe is you get the luxury of casting all these brilliant young artists who are going to be the great artists of tomorrow. You get to cast them in these roles where they might only have three or four lines, but you're getting, it's what we call luxury casting. You're getting people over 2 or 3 years are going to be singing Rodolfo and Mimi all over the world, and you get them to sing these little, you know, compromario roles. So
you're talking about the apprentices.
I'm talking about the apprentices, exactly. Yeah. So the I think that is a large part of it. I think as well, you know, when you do a new piece at most opera companies in the States, or you do an English piece, you maybe do one a season or one every other season, something like that. There, a company like Santa Fe that has sort of the guts and the integrity to do a piece like this, there aren't that many of us, you know.
Right.
And I'm speaking now as somebody who runs a regional opera. I understand the challenges of doing a piece that doesn't have the name recognition of a Bohème or a Carmen, and it means that you need to put a lot of weight behind it. You need to say that, yes, you may not have heard of this opera, but believe me, it's fantastic, it's worth your time, it's worth your money. And, you know, the Santa Fe can do that because they have such a long history of excellence. They can say anything we're going to put on this stage is going to be worth your time. And not every company has that.
And it's one of five.
It's one of five, yeah.
And so somebody might be coming into town, or somebody might be seeing two or three mm-hmm. over the course of a summer, or all five of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, the performance that I went to, it opens on Saturday night, so the opening hasn't happened yet, but I went to this youth night, dress rehearsal / youth night, and that is such an interesting audience mm-hmm. for, I would think, for you as the director, because here are all these people coming from the schools, from the pueblos, from all over the place.
My wife said there was a 12-year-old girl in the bathroom who had a very serious discussion with her mother about how she preferred this to Madame Butterfly because it was funnier. So I think that should be her tagline, more laughs than Madame Butterfly. That's I don't know how many tickets that would sell, but you know, what's wonderful about a youth night about teenagers or young folks is there's no politeness to them. If they laugh, they mean it. If they don't laugh, they mean it. It's either they don't get it or they just don't find it funny. So there is a brutality to their impressions of the piece that is very, very useful, especially when you have time to go back and say, okay, that we didn't get quite the kind of laugh we needed there, so why, you know, okay, so we need to tweak this title, or we need to have you standing further forward, or maybe we just need to do something different. And if they do laugh, that's wonderful, and it sort of reinforces what is funny, and you know, I think it was great for the performers to hear some feedback, to, you know, to get that. And, you know, laughter is the best drug of all. I mean, you can sort of see them feeding on it and getting it and thriving on it. So it was very useful in that sense.
We're talking to Ned Canty, director of The Last Savage, which is opening at the Santa Fe Opera this Saturday, the 23rd of July. It's one of those operas, and we've talked about this a great deal with Desiree, but there was a period in history where it was more about the singing than the acting. Mm-hmm. This is so much to my eye anyway, mm-hmm. about the acting. I mean, mm-hmm. the singing, it's almost like you take it for granted. You get the great singers anyway. But the people who were cast in the lead roles, particularly Kitty Scattergood mm-hmm. and Abdul and Kitty's father, they were so perfect and so funny and so so great at that satire. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how, I mean, you're the director. You bring this out of them. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? I mean, do you say, think Doris Day?
Mm-hmm. We actually did a lot of that. I gave them a list of movies that I thought they should watch that would get to the spirit and the style. And it is, there's definitely a style to this sort of comedy. There's a craft to it. To give one example, with Kevin Burdett, who plays Mr. Scattergood, there are a couple of spit takes in the opera. If for folks who don't know what a spit take is, it's, Danny Thomas was sort of the best practitioner of it, is you're drinking and someone says something shocking and you... and you spurt, water
you
or
whiskey
whatever,
all over the stage.
Whatever it is. So we decided that we wanted to try these. There are a number of shocking moments, and the idea of the spit take is very classic comedy. It was something that really reached its peak in the 60s. So we decided we wanted to try some of these, and Kevin went home on his day off, and he went on YouTube, and he got 10 or 12 different examples of Estelle Getty and Danny Thomas and Gene Wilder and all these different people doing it, and we looked at them, and we said, okay, this is really the one that we want to try. So it's a very craft-based approach. It's really about looking at how the comedy stacks up. And then from my perspective as the director, it's all about walking in having an idea for every moment in the piece, having a sense of this might be funny, we should try this, but then also having the humility and the openness to be inspired by the performers themselves. So many of the funniest things that are on stage are things that happened in rehearsal, and your job as the director is not to say, do this, that's going to be funny, but to encourage everyone to feel like they can experiment or try things and either be funny or not be funny and fail, and that even if they fail, that's okay, try something different, we'll find the right thing. So I think it really comes out of that, and your job as the director is to edit and make sure that everybody is in the same world and has the same style and is sort of playing with the same type of comedy.
The costumes and scenery was absolutely brilliant. The brilliant Alan Moyer involved in that. How do you work together? Have you been working with him for years? Is he pretty much on his own?
No, we've been working on this for about 2 years, and it is a very long process. I think that it's with a piece like this, where the style is so important and it needs to have a particular tone, having someone like Alan, who A, is a genius, but B, is doing both costumes and sets, you really get a very unified feel, and I'm glad that came across last night. We've been working for about 2 years, and the process just starts with sort of talking about the piece. We talked about these films that were important to me. I would do things like email him a picture of a hat that Doris Day wore in one of these movies and say, it's kind of like that. This is the spirit. This is the feel that it should have. And he, like all designers, has books and books and books of wonderful research. So we looked not only at pictures of colonial India, but we also looked at pictures of Hollywood and Bollywood and, different styles of architecture or clothing that seem to capture something about grandeur and something about the fun and spirit of the piece. So we looked at many, many pictures and then started winnowing it down, and we would, maybe every 2 months or so, we would get together or we would have a phone call. And in fact, a lot of the most important decisions were made when I was on a phone call we had while I was taking a train from New York to Trenton, New Jersey. And we just talked the whole time about sort of the how to break down the three acts and how to make things work technically when you have so many different settings. The piece was written for the Met, and so it was written for, almost unlimited money in the 60s, when they could do almost anything. And so what we had to do was find ways to create that same grandeur and that same scale. There's a scene where they build a wall. And when you're writing a show for the Met, you could say, great, we'll have 12 people come on and they'll build a wall on stage. And so that's what we needed to live up to, is this this level of grandeur and spectacle that Menotti had set in the original production.
And using that as an example, it was done in such a beautiful, perfect, minimal way. There are these, I guess, white cardboard boxes that get stacked up, and they sort of pretend to mortar them, and they take them down a few minutes later.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's just an example of the fact that of what unlimited wealth means. You know, the Maharaja, this idea, another big theme in it is, do you need money to be happy? And what's interesting is that, as it turns out, some of the characters do need money to be happy, but they are treated quite gently. And the ones who don't, sort of end up together and end up happy, and the ones who do end up together and end up happy. You know, it's a very, you're right, there, no one dies of consumption in this opera. It's very much a wedding kind of marriage rather than a death kind, or a wedding kind of opera rather than a death kind of opera.
Yeah, and at the end, just about everybody's happy.
Just about.
As I was watching it, I thought, there are probably some what you might call politically correct people who would object to what they're watching right now. Has anybody reacted like, oh my God, this is so, I don't know, just politically incorrect, right, or colonialist or something like that?
Not yet. I think the thing about the piece is that it is an equal opportunity teaser. Everybody comes in for a few jabs and a few pokes. There are definitely things that were funny in those days that are not as funny these days for one reason or another. The Maharani character, for instance, is very, very heavy, and so very fat. I'll go ahead and say fat. And so there's a lot in the piece where people are making fun of her for being so large, and so you have to think, well, how do we address that? You do it by sort of making her comically unbelievably large. But what's interesting, even at the time, is the character is actually sort of the smartest person on stage, and also the most sensuous person on stage is this one that everybody makes fun of. So you try to find that balance and make sure that everybody knows that that it's all in good fun. It's about teasing rather than mocking. There's nothing mean-spirited in this piece at all, which is part of what makes it so enjoyable to work on.
One thing that I thought was funny and interesting about it is that you are most definitely using the 60s style, the early 60s costumes and all of that, but you also just bring in whatever you want whenever you want. So there's cell phones in it at one little moment, and there's this moment where the character of the father makes little Nixon peace signs, which is 10 years later.
Yeah.
And you just basically have the ability to be free with cultural references.
Yeah. I think that with some of it, the cell phone moment, actually, at the very end, we sort of have a leap forward in time.
Right.
And so there is hopefully a sense that we've moved from the past to the modern day just at the very end, as a reminder of the fact that, that while this may be politically incorrect, it is satire, and we are sort of looking back at this time where it all made sense. So, but with the other stuff, comedy by necessity needs to be a little anarchic and a little free. And, if somebody in the audience is thinking, well, that wouldn't have happened, that particular dress wouldn't have been in fashion until 1965, and this is set in 1963, then I've really not done my job very well.
Right,
because
right.
Hopefully this is a piece that its only goal is to delight and entertain, to make people feel good about themselves and to make people feel good about the world, that maybe at the end of the day there can be happy endings, that people can figure things out, and that the world doesn't need to be dark and aggressive, and people don't need to constantly be fighting each other about anything, that maybe sometimes people can solve their differences and get married and find the person they're meant to be with and live happily ever after. And from my perspective as a director, thank goodness that we have stories like that still, because today more than ever, sometimes you just need to go and spend a couple of hours in the theater being reminded that human beings are human beings and always have been and always will be, and that everything's going to be okay. Trust me, it's all going to be okay.
Although I have to say that if you look at those characters and in real life try to extrapolate what people would have been like 10, 20 years later, I see divorce looming.
Potentially.
Ned Canty is General Director of Opera Memphis, Director of The Last Savage at the Santa Fe Opera. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.